Lights, camera, action. Good afternoon and welcome to the Wednesday afternoon lecture. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Dr. Jan Schnitzer. Jan received his undergraduate degree in chemical engineering from Princeton and his MD from the Pittsburgh Medical School, University of Pittsburgh, after which he postdoced at Yale. Then he spent some time at the UC San Diego and Harvard University. So you hit several of the Ivy League schools before you went back to San Diego, where he joined the faculty of the San Diego Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center in 1999. He now is professor of molecular and cellular biology and the director of the vascular biology and angiogenesis program, as well as the scientific director for the Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center. Jan today is going to tell us about his fascinating work where he uses proteomics on components of cells and the organelles in cells in order to help better direct molecular targeting of therapies. So without further ado, our speaker, Dr. Schnitzer.
I think I got it. As long as it fits in my pocket, we're set. Well, thank you very much, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here and to try to present some of the laboratory work we're doing. I want to thank Sandy and Michael for the invitation and for being such nice hosts here all day long, meeting with people here at NIH. So what I'm going to try to do is first set the groundwork. Why is it sort of clinically important to do what we do? And I think most of you will agree that there are some very significant problems to achieve our desired goal of targeted imaging of disease as well as targeted therapies. I mean, we are moving in the direction of improving targeting, but we've got a long way to go in terms of achieving the ideal of what targeted delivery could be in vivo. And part of what we see, I show in this particular slide, is that if you look at this, in many cases, it's really a delivery problem that's limiting, especially when you're talking about nanoparticles or gene vectors or antibodies, for instance, to a tumor cell surface antigen. It's clear that when you start going in vivo, things work great in vitro. I mean, that's a given. We've got lots of ways of killing tumor cells, lots of ways of treating disease in vitro. But when you go in vivo and you start injecting or applying and getting things into the systemic circulation, it's clear that in vivo barriers can prevent movement of molecules into disease tissues, including solid tumors. And this poor targeting and access to the disease tissue, and today we're primarily going to talk about tumors, if you don't have access, you can't expect a pharmacological agent to be effective. Now, these kind of agents are large. If you then go to small molecules, you sort of have the opposite problem. Small molecules can penetrate into most organs of the body. They can clearly penetrate into most disease tissues. And by doing so, they have what I call pervasive access to the normal tissues. And though you can get some of your small molecule to go to your site of interest where you want the pharmacological agent, it's going everywhere. That increases background if you're an imager. And if you're a therapy person, then that's going to increase whatever side effects. Classic example is chemotherapeutic agents. So I'm a firm believer in imaging, and you're going to see lots of imaging at many different levels today. And really, the reason I like imaging so much is that I've bought this hook, line, and sinker that is a non-invasive means to detect biomarkers and the delivery of any kind of pharmacological agent, whether it be a nanoparticle, a gene vector, or whatever. And it's truly objective. And you get a good sense in a dynamic way of exactly where these agents are going. In the end, when you look at the field, it's very clear that we need new targets And we need those targets to be accessible. And we really need new strategies to achieve targeting and perhaps more importantly, to get our drugs inside diseased tissues such as tumors. So we all know about the power of genomic and proteomic technologies today. And it's very clear that we can be looking at thousands and tens of thousands of genes and gene products with these omic technologies. And many people have applied these technologies to looking at diseased tissues versus normal, and there are thousands of potential biomarkers and target candidates in the literature. And it becomes daunting to try to figure out which one to go after and what the basis of going after them is. But what we're trying to figure out is, why are there so few valid targets? And more importantly, why can't we find targets that are, quote, targetable in vivo? So the dilemma is really, how do you choose from the thousands of candidates, which ones may be the few, what I call meaningful, accessible targets from so many thousands that are possible? And you can't do them through validation one by one by one, because that is expensive, very laborious, and takes a very long time. So what we think is a key here is to reduce the data complexity through using what we think is a new analytical paradigm that'll focus the power of omics technology, not to give you a general answer, because you asked a general question. I tell people, if you ask a non-sophisticated question with an omic technology, you will get a philosophical answer, meaning if you ask it to look at the whole tissue, don't be surprised that you're getting thousands of potential candidates. It's going to give you back what you ask. But if you focus the technology in a way to go after what you're truly trying to get, then those technologies can work in your favor, and maybe you no longer have to deal with thousands of potential candidates. So we believe we have what we call a hypothesis-driven systems biology approach to go after these targets and to reduce the overall complexity of the problem in terms of candidates by really asking what we think is the key biological question that'll focus the technology. And this question is based on the goal that we have, which is to find targets that are accessible to biological agents, in our case, antibodies, for the purposes of tissue-specific imaging, delivery, and therapy in vivo. So what part of the body, and this is the question, is inherently and fully accessible to agents that are injected, such as an antibody, into the blood? And clearly, every first-year medical student that's done a little bit of cell biology, anatomy, and physiology is going to say the lining of the vessels, which is the endothelium itself. When you inject something in the blood, the only thing you can really count on, the only thing you can really count on is the fact that it will come in contact with that endothelium, and in most organs, that endothelium is the primary barrier for that agent to get out into the tissue. So our working hypothesis, in order for this to have any relevancy to our goal, which is to get things delivered to specific sites, you have to start out with the hypothesis that tissues and the disease microenvironment ultimately can modulate the endothelial cell phenotype to the point of altering molecular expression and to the point of inducing proteins that are not normally expressed elsewhere. If that can be achieved, then you have a targeting delivery system that may be possible. Now, when we began this 15 years ago, that truly was a hypothesis. I think now, if you look through the literatures, there's tons of reasons, outside of work I'm going to present to you today, that we realize that the tissue microenvironment influences the phenotype of the endothelium, and therefore there are reasons that these molecules should be differentially expressed. Okay. I sometimes throw this slide at the end and sometimes at the beginning. I decided to do it at the beginning so you can have an overall picture of what we're going to try to do. When you start out in a tissue, you literally have hundreds of thousands of proteins and distinct proteins. Remember, post-translational modification, it's a different protein. So hundreds of thousands of candidates. And if you just do omics on all of that, you're only going to be able to assess part of it. So what we do is we break down the tissue, do subcellular fractionation, isolate a particular part of the endothelium that we're interested in, and that's less than 0.1% of what's in that tissue. And by doing that, we can actually reduce the complexity of the molecules, the molecular complexity, by at least three orders of magnitude. Then we go in and do our proteomic analysis by various different means that I will get into. The data gets put into our database called Avatar. And then at that point, once we've accumulated the data, we can then do in silico subtraction between, for instance, a normal and a diseased tissue. That gives you then a set of candidates. And look at the numbers I'm dealing with. Always more than 10, usually less than 150 candidates come out of that. That's doable, even in a lab like ours. At that point, you then bioinformatically interrogate that list of candidates. Usually you get rid of a third to a half because we're interested in proteins that are exposed and exposed with some domains outside of the cell. I don't want to find something that's in the inner leaflet of the plasma membrane because my antibodies aren't going to have access. We're going to have a barrier problem again. And then that list of proteins become the candidates that look like they could be IV accessible. We then go through the validation process of generating antibodies and doing Westerns and immunostaining, which then reduces the list down even further, and then we go in and do molecular imaging through SPECT and intravital microscopy and other techniques. To be honest, we frequently go from taking a very specific antibody and we just don't mess around, we go straight to molecular imaging. Because if it doesn't show it here, then we're not going to be that interested in it. And at the end, the molecular imaging gives us a validated set of targets and targeting antibodies. So this is sort of our strategy to target discovery and validation. So here's the beginning. Here's a tissue. Here's the endothelium. Here's a red blood cell in the center. The only thing we isolate away from all parts of the tissue is this luminal plasma membrane of the endothelium, away from all the rest of the endothelium and all the rest of the tissue. And on that plasma membrane are these little vesicles, which we really love in the lab, called cavioli. They're non-coated plasma lemma vesicles that we isolated over a decade ago. And now we start doing proteomic mapping on just that subcellular fraction. Nothing else in the tissue. How do we do that? We have a technique where we flush out a given organ. We can do whole body perfusion, single organ perfusions, etc. Flush out the blood and then coat the surface of the endothelium with colloidal silica particles. Think of colloidal silica particles as paint. The paint you put on the walls at your home. It's very, very similar. We paint the inside of the blood vessels after flushing out the blood. It coats it. It's stably adherent to it because it's positively charged. It is of a specific size that we've determined, stays specifically at the surface of the endothelium, doesn't enter the cavioli. We cross-link that on the cell surface electrostatically, and then we homogenize the tissue so that we break it up into parts. And guess what? The membrane, the luminal membrane that has now the silica particles attached to it, are much more dense than anything else that's in the tissue. So you go through a high-density centrifugation step. Everything that's in that tissue, if you were to homogenize it and try to pellet, nothing much would pellet. In fact, nothing pellets. But now, because of the silica particles, you go through a high enough density gradient. At the bottom, you'll have the silica membranes. We do that twice, because sometimes these are big sheets of membrane that get pulled down and they will trap things, and you get a nicely purified preparation. You can then go to those plasma membranes of the endothelium that you isolated. You can see the cavioli. You can separate those cavioli in various ways that we've devised from these plasma membranes and then float that up in a sucrose gradient to homogeneity as a nice fine line, pull that out, and you have 95 to 99% purified cavioli, and we've proven that with various techniques. Of course, when you're doing proteomics and subcellular fractionation, you need to make sure that you're highly enriched in markers that should be there and well depleted, in this case, because we're breaking up the cells, in markers of other compartments and other cell types. And we always do this. If it isn't 20-fold enriched by the antibody assays, it doesn't go into the omics. Because the problem is, a 3-fold, a 5-fold enrichment means I'm going to have a ton of false positives to deal with. In fact, my proteome may end up being largely the contaminant. So we try to get to the point of this 95% confidence that we're sure that we're dealing with something that's fairly limited and just exactly what we want to look at. And then we go through the step of taking these plasma membranes and cavioli. We do some what I would call classic mud pit analysis with in-solution trypsin digestion that goes straight into a two-dimensional LC-MSMS, or otherwise known as mud pit approach. And that's the classic way we've done it. We also do a series of pre-fractionations that include one-dimensional gels, cut the gel lanes, do the digestions, and then actually take each gel lane and analyze them separately using 1D as well as 2D LC-MSMS. And as for those people who are in the proteomics world, it can take us 2 weeks to analyze one gel lane on one mass spec. But in the end, we've determined that's a very useful way of doing it for comprehensive purposes. I've already made this point. And we've also determined a few years ago, and I think we were the first to do this at the time, and that is most people were just doing proteomics, even large-scale proteomics, and they would do one analysis. If you ever saw a second analysis to confirm the first analysis, that was fairly unusual. But what we decided to do is to pool a big sample and analyze it 12 times. This is just a straight mud pit analysis. And when we did that, we actually found that regardless of the order, these have all been randomized and checked, if you take the first experiment and you do a second analysis of that same sample, 66% of the proteins in the first analysis would be confirmed. But there would be 1/3 new proteins detected in that second measurement that were not found in that first measurement. And there's lots of reasons why this occurs. Okay? So what we decided to do is to determine the point at which 95% analytical completeness is achieved, which is around 7 to 8 measurements, and that's when we would stop our analysis. That's when we felt that based on that technique, we have done as comprehensive analysis of that space as possible, as we could do with that technique. And by doing that, we increased all kinds of detection of proteins that couldn't be detected in just one run. But here's a problem with doing that. There's a lot of security of doing one analysis and then analyzing one analysis of disease and one analysis of not disease and then comparing the two. Okay? But what we found is if you took 4 such measurements, mass spec measurements, and you plotted them to look at what proteins were there and the quantification of the amount of proteins are there, and you do diamond plots of this, if we were in a perfect world, everything would line up on a line because they should be identical because it's exactly the same sample. And it was all coming from one site, liver, kidney, whatever. Okay, and these were all luminal plasma membranes. But what we found is that if you quantify all of this based on spectral counts or raw ion intensities, which people do in the literature, you could see these diamond plots going all over the place. If you then use peptide number, and even if you develop some normalization approaches relative to total spectral count, it improves somewhat. But if you can't make a similar sample give you a result that's consistent across the board, then how are you going to compare normal to disease when you have all this variation that's built into the system because you've had to do all these measurements? So what we decided to do was actually look at the spectral index based on the peak height, which we capture in all of our measurements, and then we normalize that to the total spectral intensity as well as the length of the protein. And when we introduced this peak height intensity into the measurement, all of a sudden we started getting much, much, much better and much less variation between the sample. And we've done this now with 10 different measurements, and we constantly get this. This is much better than using spectral counts. So then we said, let's do the ultimate test. Let's analyze a membrane, and let's just take the 2,000 proteins that we identify, and let's compare what we get in a 40 microgram sample versus a 150 microgram sample, because the ratio should be set by the amount of protein that was loaded, because it's the same sample. And sure enough, we got a very nice linear plot with a slope of 3.72, which is very near 3.75, which it should be, with a very nice R squared. And this is over 2,000 proteins were used in making this plot. In addition, much to our surprise, and I didn't expect it to work this way, we decided to take all our data from heart and kidney, four measurements or five measurements each, and put it into an unsupervised hierarchical clustering of the samples. So all the data has been inputted, and then it decides what's the same and what's different. And when we did that, it grouped all the heart samples together, grouped all the kidney samples together, and this was done with an unsupervised, unbiased. We didn't do anything to this to bias it and set it off in that direction. So that told us that not only had we brought sameness together in terms of the same sample, but we preserved enough distinction between the samples that we could use this kind of clustering algorithm to separate the two. In addition, we found that by using the prefractionation and the mud pit analysis, we could increase the low abundant proteins, now at the nanogram scale. So we were down to 0.1 nanogram being detected in 40 micrograms of membranes that we were analyzing. In addition, we found that the protein coverage would go up whopping in terms of the peptide number that we were getting, as well as we got a big improvement in the dynamic range. Most importantly, and this is the reason we did this, we looked at these samples. We're interested in transmembrane proteins because we're dealing with plasma membrane here. We're looking for ectodomain targets. And when you use standard mud pit approaches, you really sort of select against them because you're having to do in solution digestions, etc. So when we did the prefractionations and moved more to the SDS models and subjected it to 2DLC-MSMS, we saw some big, several-fold, 4 to 6 to 7-fold increases in the number of transmembrane and multi-transmembrane proteins that were detected by using these prefractionation techniques. I would encourage everybody that's doing proteomics to really give this a try because you can really improve the comprehensiveness. It takes longer, but it's well worth it because you're getting these kinds of proteins which you want to get, not just the cytosolic and soluble proteins. Okay, so to summarize what we've done this now in multiple species in terms of isolating these membranes in rat, rabbit, rhesus monkey, and human, multiple organs and solid tumors as indicated here. The first draft of the rat endothelial cell proteome is now complete with about greater than 8,000 proteins being detected, about 1,800 non-redundant proteins, and I mean non-redundant. We believe in the parsonomy principle here so that we get this down to one hit and we have no redundancy in this, have been identified in the plasma membranes from the normals and cancerous tissues, and we have about 300 proteins that are found very concentrated in the caveolar compartment. I don't do a lot of 2D gels anymore. In fact, I think this 2D gel is close to 10 years old. But the 2D gels are nice because they give you a visualization. These are large format 2D gels. And if you run a tumor homogenate, I think this is a breast tumor model here, you can see all the proteins that you're identifying. Easily several thousand spots on these 2D gels could be analyzed. And then you look at the subcellular fraction of the tumor endothelial membranes, and you can easily see very prominent spots such as this. And then you go back to the other side, and you don't even see a hint of the protein. That shouldn't surprise you, because the endothelium is a very small part of most tissues. A fraction, 1% or less. And then the luminal plasma membrane is just a fraction of all the membrane within that endothelial cell. So you've got two orders of magnitude each time that you're diving deep, and in order to be able to pick that up, you really need to use subcellular fractionation to unmask these targets. So we've been able now to identify a whole host of what appear to be tumor-induced targets that seem to be selective: liver, kidney, lung, heart. They're quite specific within those organs based on this analysis. Others are common to two or more, and of course, many of these proteins tend to be common to all of the endothelia, plasma membranes. In the end, this tells you that there's a unique molecular signature of the endothelial cell surface in each organ. 60% are common, and about 3 to 5% of the protein appear to be unique. So far, we've analyzed about 20% of the tumor-induced targets, and this really represents a good starting point for assessing the genetic, epigenetic, and the tissue microenvironmental factors that influence the vascular phenotype and result in the tissue-specific expression that's there, and we're trying to move in that direction. So now we have a lot of data. We have a lot of molecular candidates, not thousands, but the ones we're interested in to go after. And here's where the hard work begins. Not that the proteomics is easy, but there's a lot of validation and it's time consuming. I throw this slide up only because I really, really think the level at which you do your validation and eliminate those false positives is in the end going to save you oodles of times. There's no guarantees in this business. But if you start out not looking at your probe and proving that it's specific, you can really send yourself down a path to nowhere. So you need to prove the specificity of the probe, and if it's an antibody, a Western is at least a good starting point. You need to assess target expression in the tissues and validate whatever information you're getting from the subcellular fractionation and mass spec analysis by doing that on the tissue lysates as well as on tissue sections by a variety of techniques. And then, if you're trying to target in vivo and you're trying to prove that point, you got to go in there and do biodistribution analysis by injecting, pulling organs and determining what's accumulating where and what's being targeted. Or what we usually first do is use in vivo imaging techniques that weren't available a decade ago, such as SPECT, at least in rodent models, SPECT, gamma scintigraphy, PET, luminescence, and see to what degree in a dynamic way we get accumulation in the tissue. Then at that point, we always want to know what's going on in the endothelium and how the tissue is processing the antibody. You go in there and visualize this after IV injection, and at that point, you can validate the process. Frequently in the literature, I'm not joking, tons of papers in the most prominent journal, there won't be a lick of number one, and the antibody will be bought from Santa Cruz. There'll be nothing on number two, nothing on number three, nothing on number four, and the last thing they'll do is they'll inject it in the body and they'll do a little bit of immunohistochemistry and they'll say, ooh, we got a signal in the tumor and we got nothing in the normal, and that means we targeted. Well, by immunohistochemistry, you could have 2 to 3-fold more expression of an antigen in one site, and then if you stop the reaction, you won't see the antigen in the other site, but that doesn't mean you have any real significant level of targeting, and that sure isn't dynamic, and that sure doesn't use other processes that give you a lot more real information. So what I'm saying here is you really got to go through all of these approaches, because each has their weakness, each has their strength, but if you do them all, you really can get a good idea of what's going on and you can prove that targeting is indeed occurring. So we use all kinds of imaging techniques at whole body, tissue, blood vessel, cell, and subcellular levels by EM, and I'm going to show you at least one example of each today. So this is a study we published a few years ago where we looked at a variety of lung tumors, the tumors growing in the lung, and we identified known angiogenic molecules at the time as well as some new potential tumor-induced vascular targets. And one of the targets that showed very nice specificity was annexin A1. It didn't seem to be expressed in the endothelial membranes that we isolated from other tissues, while really all the other targets that we looked at looked pretty induced, meaning there was greater expression in the tumor, but they clearly could be found elsewhere. We then immediately went on to making antibodies because the antibodies we've tried to get commercially were not specific and not very strong binders. We injected them into the rat and we were rewarded with very nice targeting specifically to the tumor site after 3 to 4 hours of IV injection. You pull out the tumor, the lungs, you can see the tumor, and even the small tumor is lighting up. In addition, when we treated these animals in a control study, we found that if we treated them or not treated them or treated them with a control antibody that was radiolabeled versus the targeting antibody, 80% of the targeted antibody animals survived. And this was a very advanced stage where we had multiple tumors in that lung system. All the animals tend to die after a week to 10 days. And in this case, 80% of them could survive after just a single injection. We then went on to say, well, we're not interested in just curing rodent tumors. Is this applicable in any way to human tumors? And we've gone on to look at a variety of different tumors. These are breast tumor samples. You can see these vessels are very nicely labeled with the antibody. And this over here is an antibody to an endothelial marker. These are nearly serial sections so that you can see the overlap and that that is indeed endothelium. If you look at normal tissues, negative. If you look at the literature on annexin, it will tell you that normal tissues are negative, clearly in terms of the blood vessels. We've now detected this by immunohistochemistry in a wide variety of tumors as listed here, and we're actually in the middle of GMP antibody production for clinical trials. Now, here I want to focus now on what we think is the next new component in this, which is the caveola with these little vesicles that I described earlier, and with the idea of finding specific targets in them and to do the proteomic imaging of this particular compartment. We've identified 300 proteins that are enriched in this compartment, and if you look at the functions based on annotation using the Go database, it's very clear that functions you would expect to be in the caveolar compartment are. There's some novel functions that we're trying to analyze and prove and validate that they indeed exist in that compartment, and we're excited about that, but I'm not going to be talking about that today. This is just another way to depict that, where you can see the enrichment based on z-scores from the database of events and processes that should be occurring at the plasma membrane and within the caveoli, while there are other aspects should be de-enriched. And then, because subcellular fractionation needs validation, this is the most time-consuming way to validate by doing EM, by immunogold labeling of ultra-thin cryosections, but if you do it and you show the protein is nicely labeling the vesicles, you've really proven the point. You've validated, it's clear it's there. We've done about 150 different antibodies on this. It's taken us about 3 years just to do this. We have about 60 now in our sample, and when we publish the caveoli proteome, all of that data will be part of that publication. So that we feel that we've now validated about 20% of that proteome, and we now feel that it's a good time to try to get that paper out, and we're in the middle of writing it. But what I want to focus on right now is using the caveoli as a means of transporting the antibody across the tissue by transcytosis. We identified a molecule called APP that was highly enriched in the caveoli of the lung endothelium in vivo, not in cell culture, but in vivo, giving a mass spec quantification that was actually higher than caveolin, which we couldn't believe, because caveolin is the major structural protein of that compartment. We made an antibody. We then took that antibody and conjugated it to gold particles, infused it into the lung, and we showed that now the gold particles, unlike the control, which you never see this kind of labeling, occasionally you see one particle here or there, very clearly the caveoli compartment is labeled. Here's a movie, I'm hoping it'll show, where we have lung tissue located right here. We've injected the antibody, and within seconds of injection, the antibody is accumulating in the site. This is a very low mag shot. People who have done fluorescence, you're doing a 2 or a 5x objective here. You know how hard it is to pick up this level of fluorescence. This is a higher mag shot. You can see the blood vessels, and I'm going to show other movies. But very clearly, we got very nice targeting. Here's still shots at even higher magnification, where you can see the nice capillary plexus, a bigger vessel here. These are all micron, 20 micron or less vessels here. And you can see the labeling after just a few seconds, and you can see at the end of 60 seconds, clearly, this whole region is labeled. This only occurs if you use the lung tissue. If you have heart or kidney or liver, you do not see this. And if you just put in another antibody, you don't see it. And it can be competed with unlabeled antibody. And if, I can go that far. In addition, we looked at singular vessels. These were vessels that were on their own, so we didn't have the complexity of other vessels. And when you do that, you can see the labeling after 5 seconds, and we've seen this multiple times, 7 seconds more, 10 seconds, and you're starting to see percolation and movement into the tissue. By the time you get to 60 seconds, there's no question there's been movement. But note this, when we first injected, we put in 30 micrograms of a control antibody that doesn't recognize any specific molecule at the surface. 30 micrograms, nice fluorescent signal, no transport. You come back after another 180 seconds of 4 minutes, still no transport. Go out 30 minutes, you still don't see any transport, no movement. But you put 10 times less of this to the point that you can't even see the signal going through the blood vessel. Okay? You see the binding first and you see the accumulation. This tells you that this is acting like an active pump. Small signal inside, hitting surface, moving across, accumulating now against a concentration gradient, indicating that the cavioli are acting like an active pump, moving it into the tissue quite rapidly. Here's a bunch of controls. We have antibodies that bind the surface of the endothelium in a lung-specific manner, but not in the cavioli. We've gone out 30 minutes with these antibodies, and they don't transcytose at all. You don't get the pumping action. You can quantify this by doing signal intensity time space profiles. The main point here is, as you can see the movement when it targets the cavioli, all your controls stay in the vascular compartment or bind the cell surface or do both. And then if you go in and you knock out caveolin, which causes the cavioli to disappear, you can prevent this movement into the tissue. So cavioli are pumping the antibody rapidly and actively into the lungs, even against a gradient. Without this targeting and without the cavioli, the transport doesn't occur. And this told us that rapid, active, targeted transcytosis is indeed possible in vivo. So now that's intravital microscopy. We said, okay, let's go back to the rat. Let's do some gamma scintigraphic imaging. Let's take half-second shots for a full minute, because if this works, at a full minute, what are you going to have? All lung labeling. That's exactly what we did. Show it one more time. There it comes up, goes into the chest cavity. By the end of 60 seconds, where is it? It's specifically in that lung tissue. So we used an independent technique to confirm the specificity and rapidity of targeting. We then used SPECT CT to make sure that we're getting lung labeling, and sure enough, that's exactly what you can see here. So this was published less than a year ago, approaching a year actually now, in Nature Biotech. And then the following month in April, Napoleon Ferrara wrote a little News and Views on this. And he really summarized the point. If you have cavioli and you have the target and you got an antibody to get to that target, it'll bind quickly. And within 30 seconds or so, you can see very significant evidence of movement into that tissue. Okay? And by 60 seconds, there's even more. If you don't have cavioli because the caveolin has been knocked out, you'll see binding at the surface, but you won't see movement into the tissue. And then, of course, if you go to other tissues that don't have the specific target, whether they have cavioli or not, it doesn't make any difference. You get minimal movement into those tissues. Now, we were interested, and we have one of these Nano Alliance grants, to look at, can we use this cavioli targeting pathway to deliver nanoparticles? Because now we want to go a little bit bigger than antibodies. So we're beginning to conjugate bigger and bigger things to our antibody. Here's a 5-nanometer gold particle, went up to 20, went up to 40. And you can indeed see targeting of the lungs. Of course, these particles also show some accumulation in the liver. If you just did a non-specific one, within 10 minutes, you would see very significant liver staining, and this is about the 5 or 10 minute time point. So we're now hoping that this gives us a way to deliver nanoparticles, and we're currently investigating that within the lab. And gene vectors, I should say. Now, I'm showing you a movie here. There's a prominent technique out in the literature called in vivo phage display. And what you do is you inject a phage library, antibody or peptide, into the circulation, and you then remove out the organs to see if you can find phage that have specific targeting to those organs. And we thought, oh, what a great opportunity. We have one antibody that is truly lung specific, and we have several, and we pulled out the gene, sequenced it, got the single chain FV, incorporated it into the phage, showed that the phage was binding, and said, let's inject this into the rats and use this as sort of a positive control, and then eventually use it to spike our library so that we can figure out how to optimize all of this. The problem was, as we've done this about 5 different times, every single time, what do you get after just 1 minute of injection? 90% of your signal is in the liver. This is where the antibody goes, even as a single chain FV or an FAB. This is where it goes when it's part of the phage. So by doing that, we kind of said, oh my gosh, we just can't do, at least in our hands, in vivo panning of phage libraries. Because if the liver's sucking everything out, 90% of everything, within just a minute or two, then how will those molecules have a chance to interact with any other part of the animal? Because once it goes through the liver, it stays there. So we developed a technique that we published about 2 years ago where we started screening these on our membranes, meaning isolate the membranes, screen it sort of like an ELISA on the membranes or on sort of a filter paper Western type directly so that we would get bands. And in the process of doing that, and I'll give you the very short version of this, we came up with lots of candidates. And of course, we went into vivo for Veritas to prove, and we injected those, all those phage, that looked like they were fairly specific, and they all went to the liver. So then we said, okay, we believe our blots, we believe the specificity that we're getting through our assays, let's get rid of the phage and let's keep the single chain FV. And we took that single chain FV and we used it to make a mini body so that we could have 2 binding sites, which is obviously helpful. Inject it into the body, and what'd you get? Targeting. If the blots showed it was lung specific, the molecular SPECT imaging showed it was lung specific every single time. If the blots showed it was in lung and kidney, that's what we got, lung and kidney. So it wasn't the screen and it wasn't the phage approach, it was the phage itself that you put in vivo that the liver just couldn't help but pull out completely. And we know about the RES system, and that, of course, is plaguing nano delivery and gene vector delivery, at least systemic delivery, in many experiments. Okay, now let's get to the most interesting part. What can we do with tumors? And this is, again, all unpublished data here. We have antibody to a protein we call TC1. We put the antibody on gold particles. We target the cavioli. The gold particles now do, controls do not. They do not target any other tissue. We then go in and use the intravital microscopy system. And in this case, we're progressing in the lab. We made the tumor green with a histone 2B cherry FP that we got from Roger Chen right down the street. And so the tumors are red here. We could know exactly where the tumors are. We inject the antibody, and you can start seeing signal here, start seeing some signal, but clearly 30, 45, and by 60 minutes, we have a little mini Chernobyl going on here. You go back and overlap it, and the red and the green overlap very, very nicely. You can quantify this. You do any of your controls, they're way down here. Non-specific antibody, or if you look at the nearby breast tissue in this case, this is a breast fat pad preparation, you'll see there's very little delivery outside of the tumor. Now let me show you the movie that goes with this. I think I have to click on this one. Be patient. This is 30 minutes accelerated. You saw the red tumor, which is in the center. Now hopefully it's moving along. Do we see anything? Oh, come on. Why isn't it on the screen? It's here. It's not there. Is there anything you can do? Because this is like the highlight. This is what I want to show. Let's try it one more time. Oh, you don't even see the red tumor. You saw it for a fraction of a second, I think, when I did it the first time. It's showing up on my screen. It showed earlier on both screens, but it's not showing anywhere else. I would skip it, but I'd like to show it because sort of... I don't mind you backing up if you want. Yeah, and then you just have to click on it. See, that part it doesn't like. We tested this beforehand so this wouldn't happen. And it worked, right?
Yeah, it did.
You'll vouch for me on that? Yeah. And one or two people were in the crowd. Barbara, right? It worked? Yeah. I may just have to turn the computer around and show it to you. Because you can see it, and maybe the only thing we can do... Oh, there it is. I hope... Oh. Okay. Let's back it up. And that's literally what I'm going to do. Okay. Let's put it here. Let's go to the next one. Up. Oh. Let's click. Where's my hand? Let me get the hand. Okay, there's my hand. Let's click on it. Okay, can you see anything? Okay, so you saw the red. Now you have to be patient at the beginning. You're not going to pick up the subtleties of what occurs in the first 15 minutes, and it's being sped up. But when you get around 30 minutes, I think even from where you are, you're going to see the accumulation that's occurred. It's hard to see it at that low level, but if we do the imaging at a level we can detect the low stuff, by the time you get to the high stuff, it's just blowing out the camera. Okay, and by the end, that's 45 minutes. Yep, see on cue. This is less than 1 month old data, so that's why we're still so excited about it. So at the end of 60 seconds, you really have a little mini Chernobyl going on there. And since we end up using radioactivity, I really can say that. Okay. So I think what you saw is consistent with this image, because we obviously took the frames from that. In addition, we've attacked this with higher resolution, higher magnification, where you can see individual blood vessels, and these are the smallest vessels that you'll see within the tumor. And you can actually see this time course, you know. You can actually see binding at 20 seconds and 30 seconds, movement into some parts, like here, in 1 to 3 minutes. And then other parts, like over here, tend to stay dark for a while. But clearly when you're getting to 1 hour and definitely 2 hours, you know, this is pretty saturated and full of signal. If you look at different regions, which we did, such as this circle versus this, this one was slow, this one was fast, and you can see the different dynamic that occurs. And we see that throughout the tumor. Okay? In addition, we've gotten lucky and been able, after imaging like 15 of these as individual vessels, okay, not taking them out, just finding solitary vessels, and we can see evidence of very fast binding and movement into the tissue. So in some cases it could bind really fast and pump in. Other cases maybe you're not getting the flow there, maybe it's intermittent. There's lots of reasons why it'll take longer. And then if you do the controls, very important, we inject a red fluorophore labeled antibody. This is at 5 minutes. Where's the red fluorophore? It's inside the vessel. This is not a leaky blood vessel. Remember, tumors have occasional leaky vessels. So this isn't what's going on here. If you knock out the caveolin, we've gone out to 30 minutes. You don't see any movement. And the same thing if you knock out the antigen itself, TC1. At the bottom here, I have a lower MAG image, because this is high MAG, and you can accuse me of being selective. So here's a nice low MAG image that shows what we get in tumors. It's a lower MAG image and shows what you see now in the CAV knockout. Now this is a movie that's showing. It's not as good as the other movie, but it shows what occurs when we get lucky and we find a region where we have fast transport. So within, this is real time, 7 seconds, 8 seconds, you're seeing the binding occur. Now we're trying to focus in on the right plane because we don't always have exactly the right plane. And about 18 seconds we get there, and you can see these vessels nicely labeled, multiple vessels. This is an area where the capillary plexus exists. There's no question in under 30 seconds we've achieved binding, and in many cases we have evidence that there was transport. So this just shows you what can occur in regions of that tumor, and it can indeed be fast, and we were able to capture it. Now we've gone on and done SPECT imaging. This is the lungs that we've taken out and decided to rotate on the SPECT imager. And they had multiple tumors so that you could see all of those tumors very nicely labeled. You can then do biodistribution analysis where you take out all the organs, whole organs first, and here you see that the normal organs aren't labeled. The lungs with tumors will, of course, have radioactivity. And then you can go back and carve out the tumors, and you get about 35% of injected dose. This should be per gram in the tumor. And the total, they're usually 1.5 to 2.5 gram tumors. You can then go on and do SPECT CT. This is a HER2 new model, which has the tumors present here. And sure enough, that's what you're labeling very nicely and very specifically in these models. In this case, it's a lutetium label. We've also used a variety of different models. This was a colon tumor model system that we had, and it spontaneously gave us a signal because of a metastasis in the liver. So of course, we took out that liver, and kidney, and sure enough, we saw the radioactivity there. So then we were interested, can we image and can we use this for therapy? So we went back to the intravital microscopy model. In this case, the tumor cells have a green GFP in it. And what you do is use different amounts of antibody, 0.3 to 3 micrograms. These are all iodine-125 labeled antibodies. 30 microcuries at this point, so it's 10 microcurie per microgram. And at this activity, you can see pretty close to complete ablation. 80% of the time the tumors don't appear. Sometimes you need a second injection at about 10 days to 2 weeks when the tumors reappear and you can knock them out. We've tried this now in a whole host of different kinds of tumors in this IVM system. What we see is anywhere from 13 hours to 30 hours, blood flow stops in the tumor. Selectively in the tumor. At that point, you've already pumped your antibody into the tumor. So that stoppage of blood flow is good for two reasons. One is, infarcting a tumor is a good thing. And two is now that radioactivity is trapped in that tumor where it can churn and churn and churn and do the radioactive damage that it can do. Frequently, we don't even get hot thyroids for quite a long time. Remember, antibody in the circulation, after 4 hours, your thyroid starts going up because the iodine comes off the antibody through dehalogenation in blood. Ends up killing both stromal and tumor cells. If we do this in a situation where there's no caveolin present in the host tissue and thus in the endothelial cells, you do the control, you knock it out. You do it with the caveolin knockout, as shown here, tumors just grow just very nicely. And this, of course, was the control allowing it just to grow and compare. Maybe a little bit of an effect, and we haven't done enough of these to know if that's real, but clearly, without caveoli, this effect does not occur. And we can talk about why. I'll say one thing. Remember, if it binds on the cell surface and sits there, 12 hours later, that radioactivity has all been clipped off of that antibody through dehalogenation because of the blood that's circulating by it. And we've seen that with other antibodies. And the thyroid just starts screaming. And by 24 hours, I'm not sure there's any more radioactivity there. Okay, so by targeting the radioimmunotherapy via the cavioli, we think you create what we call a tumor sarcophagus. You get deep penetration, you stop the circulation, as I said, the flow through the tumor blood vessels. That creates anoxia. You've trapped the radioactivity inside the tumor where it can kill all the elements within the tumor. We see that within 3 to 10 days in all the models that we've done. In addition, as you're killing tumor cells, and they're dying, they're releasing proteolytic enzymes. So this proteolytic environment is probably helping us by cleaving some of the IgG. Maybe we're getting smaller and smaller radio-iodinated peptides. And then those peptides will have a better ability than a whole IgG to just find all the little nooks and crannies within the tumors and mop up any potential surviving cells. In the end, it obviously takes weeks for these tumors to disappear. And we're wondering, maybe we're going to induce some sort of immune response, but we haven't gone down that road to see if this is actually applicable. So the cavioli represent a portal into the tissue to deliver agents across normally restrictive barriers, to increase bioefficacy within seconds to minutes in normal tissues and minutes to hours, at least in the tumor models. And you're really getting it to the intended target of most therapies, which are the cells deep in the tissue. It may be enabling for a whole variety of different approaches as indicated here. Through using this tissue organellar approach, I think it's enabled our systems analysis of the disease and the targets. By doing the subcellular fractionation, we can unmask meaningful target subsets. And one way that we've defined one way to identify what we call the accessible target space, and a subset of this target space, at least through the cavioli, may be what we're calling the transvascular pumping space. This approach to omics contrasts to the more standard omics approach that I discussed at the beginning of the talk, where you accumulate huge amount of data and then you try to bioinformatically sift it down to what you're interested in. Another way of showing this diagrammatically, millions of possibilities, subcellular fractionation. It's a funnel, gives you a few sets of targets, which you then use molecular imaging to validate. And at that point, you can move this towards going to the clinic, which we have one molecule that we're doing now, and should be in the clinic hopefully within a year. So we've created an imaging and drug delivery system that's based on these two target space and that has been defined through organellar proteomic mapping. I think the other near two benefits of this pharmacodelivery system is maybe we can retarget past drugs that have really been quite effective in vitro but maybe had a delivery problem and that's why they failed in the clinic. I'm sure all of you can come up with names of such drugs. Maybe they were toxic for some reason, and because you had to put out such a high dose in the patient to see any efficacy, those toxicities were compounded. So clearly, if we could deliver them there at 100-fold less being injected, 100-fold more getting to the tumor, these agents may prove to be very, very effective with retargeting. The same can be true even for agents that are currently clinically considered positive. All of these agents, as indicated here, could benefit greatly from improved delivery into the tumor. And they could thereby be rendered more effective. And in the case of Avastin, maybe certain side effects would decrease. Maybe its efficacy would increase. That would be a nice thing. So, and as I said earlier, enhancement for nanodelivery as well as viral gene therapy. Do I have time to go through 5 more slides, or should I cut this off? Okay, just real quickly, people have asked me about tissue microenvironment, and various people I talked to this morning wanted me to show these slides where we actually put tumors in different tissue and microenvironments in these intravital microscopy preparations. And we put these tumor spheroids in different tissues in these preps. And when we do that, And this is where cutting this off affects it a little bit. In this case, these were Lewis lung tumor spheroids. If you grow them in lung, you get beautiful tumor growth, beautiful angiogenesis. The tumor is really vibrant, doing well. If you grow them in skin, it grows a lot slower. Though if you allow this to grow for another 10 days, it will catch up and become as big as this. Okay? It just takes longer to adapt and get going. Here's the critical thing I wanted to bring up. And that is if you... In this case, there's a breast tumor model growing in the breast fat pad. And if you look at that versus it growing in skin, and here you have fluorophore-labeled IgG, in the fat pad, so this is orthotopic, you get very little evidence of movement into that tissue of that IgG, basically none. If you go to the skin model, they're very leaky, very, very leaky. You can do a dextran fluorophore, you get the same result, and you can quantify that. So in the end, it's clear that tumors vary in their leakiness. I don't think they're as leaky as people say they are. The sub-Qs clearly are. But the orthotopic ones, they're not as leaky, and the clinical human ones may be even less leaky than those. So they're sporadically leaky, but overall the barrier is more restrictive than we think it can be. And clearly it's not as... impermeable, let's say, as normal vessels or as permeable. It's more permeable. But the sub-Qs are very, very, very leaky. And it is the microenvironment that can influence that leakiness. So in the end, is it really surprising that we have dozens of ways to treat subcutaneous tumors and we read dozens of papers that make subcutaneous tumors disappear? Because if you can inject an agent and just pump it up high enough, if I can get an IgG to give that kind of signal after 15 minutes, why shouldn't it be effective? You don't have a delivery problem. But when you go to the orthotopic tissue, you have a huge delivery problem. In addition, let's be cognizant of the fact that clinically we give 10 mg per kg, a very not unusual number for us to give to a patient. That would translate upon injection to 150 mg per liter in blood. Anybody who's done a Western blot, you do 1 microgram per mL and you get a screaming signal. You go down to nanogram levels and you can get good signal with good antibodies. So it really tells you we have a delivery problem, and it sure isn't like the subcutaneous tumors. Okay? So I think I said all those points. We decided to go one step further and treat the skin tumors versus the orthotopic tumors with doxorubicin. Huge literature. It works nicely at 1 mg and 5 mg per kg, so we did that. Sure enough, you can see nice tumor stasis, a little bit of growth. At 5 mg, pretty much no growth. You go to the orthotopic model, and at 1 mg per kg, it's laughing at you. That tumor's just growing just perfectly fine. It sure didn't in the control. At 5 mg, it's coming down a little bit, and you can quantify that small difference. But clearly, you're not getting the static effect that you get in the skin model. I'm not going to belabor this. We've knocked out particular proteins, and we've seen huge effects on the vascularity as well as tumor growth. This TC1 protein is clearly an important endothelial protein. And we've seen actually the opposite. We knocked out caveolin. And I'll tell you, caveolin creates the most pretty tumor blood vessels. If you use host tissue without caveolin, the blood vessels are just beautiful, and they grow very, very, very fast. And it's much different than in the control. So you can knock out a specific gene, and you can, in the host environment, not in the tumor cell, and you can have a huge effect on the growth of the tumor. And we're developing these systems in the lab. These were all done with transgenic tissues. I think I've made all those points. So in the end, I just summarize and say that the host stroma includes the extracellular matrix, vascular, perivascular, infiltrating elements, and you can knock out a specific gene within the host tissue, can have a huge effect, both positive and negative. The host environment can have a huge effect on tumor growth, metastasis, angiogenesis, vessel leakiness, and thereby an effect on therapy. So one needs to consider the stroma as a target for therapies. And in our case, where we focus on the endothelium, which is indeed part of the stroma, it can provide accessible targets. So in the end, we've developed a targeted delivery system where we try to find these little Y molecules on the surface of the endothelium and hopefully in the cavioli as a means to deliver things specifically to that system. Think of it as affinity chromatography, where the blood vessels, the capillaries of the tissues are like the capillaries in the chromatography beads. If the antigen is there and the interaction is there, it will bind. But if it's not, it will flow through. And this delivery strategy now can get us into and penetrate the tumors themselves. Just want to thank the people that did most of the work. Phil O, who probably did 3/4 of the work I showed today. the imaging group, the proteomics group, tissue subfractionation, because we have to go through about 30 animals a week in terms of isolating these fractions, bioinformatics, and the hybridoma group that developed all of the monoclonal antibodies, and Philippe's work with the phage that I did describe, and Pelle Borgstrom, who we collaborate with at our institution, doing all of the intravital microscopy. Thank you very much. Oh, I guess I have to add this slide, since I'm at NIH and since the preponderance of our grant support has come from the heart, lung, blood, and the NCI in these efforts, so I want to acknowledge that. Thank you.
We could entertain one question before we go to the reception where Jan will be available for further discussions.
What is the differential distribution of the caveolin in the normal, so-called normal endothelial cell versus...
I didn't get the beginning of that. What kind of endothelial cell?
The concentration of the caveolin in a healthy endothelial cell versus tumor endothelial
okay.
cell.
That depends on the particular organ you're dealing with. If you're in lung and heart, there's a huge abundance of cavioli. 50% of the endothelial plasma membrane at the microvasculature can be cavioli. If you're going to other organs, liver, zero. You will not find a single caviola on a liver endothelium. We've done EM on this. If you go to brain, I think it's closer to zero than anything else. Other organs are sort of intermediate. If you go to tumor, it's about lung tumors in comparison to lung tissue is about tenfold less in the number of cavioli, between 5 and 10-fold. But they are clearly present, and they're also present in brain tumor endothelium.
So if you look at the uptake of the radioactivity in the normal lung tissue versus
yes.
Metastasized lung tissue or lung right. tissues as such, what is the target to non-target ratio?
What is the one?
Target to non-target ratio.
Oh, 100-fold.
So what is the rate of transport? I mean, how they are transporting, obviously.
Yeah, but see, in one case you have a target, regardless of whether you have cavioli. If you have cavioli, that's half the story. But if the cavioli doesn't have the antigen that the antibody binds to, then that antibody is minimally, only by fluid phase, ever going to enter that caviola. But in the case of the tissue that has the target in the caviola, once it enters, it will stay there. Okay, and that's where you get the pumping action.
Well, the results look impressive.
Thank you.
Okay. So there, the reception is out in the lobby. Just keep going back. You'll bump into tables with food. And Jan will be available for further discussions with anybody that's interested. Thank you.